What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Secretary Michael Chertoff. Michael Chertoff is an attorney who was the second United States Secretary of Homeland Security. He was also an architect of the USA Patriot Act, which we certainly discuss. Chertoff previously served as a United States Circuit Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, as well as a federal prosecutor and an assistant U.S. Attorney General. He succeeded Tom Ridge as U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security on February 15, 2005. Since leaving government service, he's also co-founded the Chertoff Group, which is a risk management and security consulting company. We discuss a lot in this episode. We discuss his time as Secretary for the DHS, the challenges he faced and how he managed them, prosecuting the only person ever convicted in U.S. court in connection with the September 11th attacks, leadership, and much, much more. And I will leave it there. And now I give you Secretary Michael Chertoff. Okay, I'm here with Secretary Michael Chertoff. Very excited to be speaking with you, sir. I want to discuss certainly Homeland Security, Enron, to name a few. But before we do, I'd love to wind the clock back a little bit. I'd love to ask you, what made you want to become a lawyer?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. I think I graduated from college. It wasn't clear what I was going to do. My parents said, you need to think about getting a job that you can support yourself on. I wasn't good at science, so I wasn't going to be a doctor. So by default, I went to law school, and I discovered I really liked it. I enjoyed thinking about problems and getting practical solutions as opposed to just theoretical rumination.
Sure. I understand that. That makes sense to me. From 79 to 1980, you were a law clerk for Justice William Brennan. I'd love to know what that experience was like, Mr. Secretary, and what did it teach you?
Well, you know, for any lawyer, I just graduated from law school, clerking for a judge, and particularly Supreme Court justice, is a great privilege. And it gives you insight into the way judges actually work in the real world. And Justice Brennan was a legend. His politics were not exactly mine, but I realized he was the judge and I was a law clerk. So I had to simply embody his views in the things I researched and did drafts of. And he was a wonderful human being. He was very open with his clerks. There was a lot of contact. We used to have coffee with him every weekday morning, and we talk about cases or current events. And so it was a great education in the traditions of the court, the judicial process, and in particular, the way the Supreme Court dealt with some very, very big issues. One of the takeaways from my experience is, while people on the outside sometimes assume that the justices who disagree with each other have some kind of personal animosity, nothing could be further from the truth. Justice Brennan was very friendly with the conservative justices on the court. They had lunch together on a regular basis. They communicated with each other. They exchanged views. There was absolutely no personal dimension to the disagreements they had on issues of legal philosophy.
Back when we could separate out politics and personal, I'm very interested in discussing Enron with you, Mr. Secretary. You know, you led the prosecution's case against Arthur Anderson. Could you please talk a little bit about that and how you became involved with it?
Yeah, I was the head of the criminal division of the Department of Justice, and the Enron failure, which was a result of a significant fraud in terms of overstating the assets and the revenues, had a multi-state impact. It wasn't just in a single judicial district, but the effect of it was felt all across the country. So it was clear that the Department of Justice in Washington needed to take a coordinating role. And we actually put together a task force and to look at all the dimensions of Enron, including Arthur Anderson, which was the accounting firm that signed off on all the false financial records. So we needed to make this a very, very high priority issue for the department. Now, one of the features of this was that Enron was a Texas company. The head of Enron and the top executives knew the Bush family. there was a little bit of a concern that people had in the press about whether they would, you know, the result would be going easy on Iran. But in fact, President Bush was adamant that the people who did something wrong should be held accountable. And he didn't want to give any favoritism or any preference just because he knew somebody or someone was from Texas. Call it straight, do what you have to do and be tough. And I think, you know, I believe that that was a very, very important observation on his part, because one of the critical issues in our democracy is holding people accountable, powerful people accountable, in the same way that we hold people who are not powerful accountable. So we went at the Enron case, we wanted to be fair, but we wanted to make sure that we uprooted any fraud or misconduct, and we treated it very seriously, and we went after it using the full power of the law. Now, part of the issue we had to deal with was Arthur Andersen. And in the period once the investigation began, in one of the offices in Texas, which had been involved in doing the auditing, the head of the office ordered that relevant documents and files be destroyed, even though they were part of what the investigation was calling for. That is what they typically call obstruction of justice. And so part of what we wanted to investigate was their obstruction of justice. At some point, they came in and they wanted to cut some kind of a deal. And what they suggested was, why don't you do with us what you've done before with us in other cases? Set up a monitorship, someone to supervise us going forward, and, you know, don't charge us with a crime. But if we satisfy you that we've completed the monitorship period, complying with the rules going forward, you'll dismiss the case again. And we talked about it. And one of the things, you know, among the prosecutors we said was, look, we need to make sure that they admit the wrongdoing. We don't want to give them the opportunity, as has been the case in the past, to say, oh, there was nothing to see here. We just signed an agreement so it wouldn't have to be, you know, brought to a trial. So when we met with a senior leadership, the accounting firm, we said, you have to guilt. You have to admit you did something wrong, because there's no doubt you did it. In fact, we had a guilty plea from the senior person involved. And then if you do that, we could do a monitorship, but there has to be an admission of guilt. And they said, no, we can't do that because that's going to hurt our business. I said, well, wait a second. How is it going to hurt your business to admit to something that everybody knows that you've done? You've admitted, for example, on many occasions in the SEC, you've signed agreements where you admit wrongdoing. And the individual from Arthur Andersen says to me, well, but that's different. Everybody understands with accounting firms, you have to agree to things with the SEC. It's kind of a cost of doing business. But if we admit wrongdoing to the Department of Justice, that's going to be taken very seriously, and that's going to hurt us. That was exactly the wrong comment to make, because it made clear what they were looking to do is to duck accountability. And so we said, sorry, we're not going to agree to that. We're going to take the case to trial.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. You allow me also a smooth transition in part of your answer, sir. Can you please describe for me the first time you met President Bush?
You know, I had worked as U.S. attorney under his predecessor, you know, his father, President Bush 41. I was working on a campaign a little bit, giving some advice, and I was called up by the Department of Justice and asked would I be interested in a nomination to be Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division. I met with the Attorney General, that was John Ashcroft, and some of the other folks, and I said I'd be very interested in doing that. The president nominated me, and I took office. I actually didn't meet the president until after 9/11. I was on duty on September 11th, and there was no Homeland Security Department. So I and the FBI director, Bob Mueller, were responsible for the response to the terrorist attack and the next steps. That obviously engaged President Bush very much on a personal level. So we wound up having meetings on a regular basis, almost a weekly basis, with the president about what we were doing, what was going on. And when I became Secretary of Homeland Security, it became even more regular. And that's how I met the president and got to know him, by talking about the issues we were confronting, what our response was going to be, and what we needed to do in terms of changing the law and getting additional resources to make sure this didn't happen again.
Yes, understood. I'd love to ask you, sir, you may have already mentioned it in your previous answer, and if you did, just tell me and I'll move on. But I do feel inclined to ask nonetheless, do you remember where you were on 9/11?
Yes, I absolutely remember. I was in my car driving into work. I had my car phone on. I was talking to my deputy. And as I was coming, you know, in near the Department of Justice, he set a plane into World Trade Center. Like a lot of people, I thought some small plane got turned around. We kept talking. He had the TV on. He said a second plane did. And we said, this is not an accident. So I arrived a few minutes later. We walked across to the FBI, the fifth floor where they have the operations center. I met with Bob Mueller, who I knew from many years going back. And we sat down with the FBI, and the first order of business was figuring out who did this. One of the challenging and painful things I had to do was make a couple of calls to people who had loved ones on the planes that went down and who had spoken to the loved ones who were called from the airplanes. And we did that in part to begin to triangulate where the hijackers were sitting so we could get their identities. And once we started that process, we were able to use data about, for example, credit cards and similar types of financial transactions to connect them up with each other and to connect them up with known Al-Qaeda operatives in other parts of the world. So within a day, we knew it was bin Laden, we knew it was Al-Qaeda, and then we began the process of making sure there weren't more facts coming. Obviously, the Pentagon happened, and then there was the plane that was shot down over Shanksville. But we didn't know that was all. We thought there could very well be other attacks. For example, there was a rumor that taxi cabs in Washington had bombs in their trunks. And we worried about whether there might be a biological or a chemical attack. And so we were lucky nothing else happened, or it would be very, very bad. We didn't know that until some considerable time thereafter. Much of what we did was a frenetic effort to shut down anything that was in the works that could even make matters more perilous.
Yeah, I understand that. I've had the honor of interviewing a number of people that were first responders, firefighters, and so forth. All of them have more or less said the same thing to me. I remember they told me that the taxi cab concern, particularly, they were worried about. Never forget that. From 2001 to 2003, if my information was correct here, sir, you headed the criminal division at the DOJ, and you led the federal prosecution's case against Zacharias Moussaoui. This would lead to him becoming the only person ever convicted in a U.S. court in connection with 9/11 attacks. I'd love to know, Mr. Secretary, can you please speak a little about that case and what leading the investigation was like?
And I didn't try the case. In fact, when the case went to trial, I had already left to go on a court of appeals, but I did supervise it, and I argued one of the appeals in the Fourth Circuit. So how I learned about this was, you know, day or two after 9/11, the court, the FISA court, supervised the collection of foreign intelligence, changed or suspended a rule that had previously forbidden for the criminal division or criminal prosecutors to get access to intelligence records that were gathered under the intelligence authorities. There was supposed to be a wall between intelligence agencies and intelligence collection and domestic law enforcement. But given what had happened, given the fact that most of the hijackers were in the U.S. when they got on those planes, actually they all were, the court lifted that ban and allowed us to look at the intelligence. And one of the things that I discovered reading through files was that there had been an investigation of Zacharias Moussaoui by an FBI agent in Oklahoma where Moussaoui was going to flight school. And one of the things the agent communicated to his superiors is we need to get authority for a search or for wiretaps or other kinds of process because here's an individual who is at no possibility of ever being a pilot. Why is he going to flight school? And he's seems to be connected to people that we know as potential Al-Qaeda people. And so, and what he actually remember, what stunned me was, if we don't investigate this guy, we could wind up with another World Trade Center bombing, like the one back in 1993. This memo had been written weeks before the actual 9/11 attack. So it was prescient. And so we realized this was someone who was a wannabe hijacker, was preparing to be a hijacker. And as we later learned, at the last minute, bin Laden kind of said, no, he's not up to it. But he was certainly part of the conspiracy. And so based on that, and based on financial connections he had to a known Al-Qaeda financier named Al-Hawsawi, we were able to put together a case and bring it against Moussaoui.
Yes. Thank you, sir. As you look back on your legal career, is there a particular accomplishment that you're especially proud of? Would it be Moussaoui?
Well, I mean, certainly the 9/11 response was something, it was a very memorable and important thing I did. I mean, the part that, in the sense of just something that's purely legal as opposed to security, I think probably the mafia prosecutions are the most memorable. I mean, I did the commission case, which was a racketeering case against the bosses of four of the five New York mafia families who constituted what was called the commission, which is the board of directors of La Cosa Nostra in the United States that set the rules for all mob members, all mafia members in the United States. And we put together a case involving a murder, a massive conspiracy involving the construction industry in New York, where 4% of every concrete contract had to be paid over to the mob, and half of that went to the commission. And then there were some miscellaneous things like loan sharking. So that was a very painstaking case to put together. Ironically, it was originally going to be prosecuted by Rudolph Giuliani, and I was supposed to assist him. But about 6 months before the trial, he decided to try Stanley Friedman, the Bronx borough president. And so I wound up being the lead lawyer with two other more junior lawyers working with me on the commission case. It was a very fascinating case, very high profile. It was probably the biggest case against the mob ever brought. And happily, everybody was convicted.
Excellent. Yes. So it was January 11th, 2005, you got word that you were nominated to succeed Tom Ridge as the Secretary of Homeland Security. Do you remember where you were and how you heard about it?
Yeah, what actually happened was a few days earlier, I'd gotten a call from the White House about whether I'd be willing to be considered to be the head of Homeland Security because Bernie Kerik had flopped because he had some problems in his background. So I said, well, I'm willing to consider it. They said, come down, we want to talk to you. I went down, I met with the chief of staff, Andy Card, and a couple of the other people in the White House. And on the way back, I actually got a call saying the president would like to see you. I said, well, I can't physically get back today. I think it was like a Friday or something like that. But I'm happy to come over the weekend. So we went home. I discussed it with my wife. I mean, it was obviously going to be a big step giving up life tenure and moving again back to Washington. But having lived through 9/11 and been involved and having looked people in the eye who lost loved ones and had them say to me, don't let this happen again, it was probably the one job I couldn't say no to because I really felt like, understandably, we're in a war. In a war, when they ask you to be a general leading the troops, you don't say, no, I'd rather be home. So I went back the next day. I met with the president. He knew me because I had worked on the 9/11 since in the first year and a half after 9/11. And the next day, he called me and offered me the position, and I accepted.
Wonderful. Thank you. So Homeland Security was a merger of 22 federal agencies into one department, which, if my notes were correct, it was the largest reorganization in the federal government's modern history, something that may or may not be remembered by a majority of people. You were on a panel with Tom Ridge as well as Janet Napolitano, and you told Admiral Thad Allen back in 2011, sorry for all the names and dates there, that one of the basic challenges was, to quote you, to get within the department a culture of jointness, shared understanding of the mission, and shared execution of the mission, which is part of any organization and particularly important when you're bringing in constituents from a lot of different agencies, some of which had varying degrees of enthusiasm about being put into a large agency, end quote. So my question, after all that bluster, what were some of those key challenges that you faced during that process?
Well, first, there was a new department. It was less than 2 years old. So a lot of the sinews and muscles that you have in a department just deals with the bureaucratic stuff, you know, ethics issues, legal issues, getting paperwork out. All of that had to be built and was in the process of being built. So the central core were still relatively immature. Although technically there are 22 independent groups that were brought together, many of them were very small things like the Office of Civil Rights or the General Counsel's Office. But there were about eight major operational agencies that were brought together, like the Coast Guard, TSA, Secret Service, and a number of others. And the key was to get the value out of the department, was to be able to coordinate, to pool resources, and have joint activity with each other. It's very similar to the military. You have multiple combatant commands, and you have also support groups. And you have a lead command, then you have a supporting command, then you have other groups that may be involved with supplying things or providing ancillary services. And after the Department of Defense was created, there was the famous Coldwater Nichols Act about a decade or so later that actually built the idea of a joint staff and having the capability to bring unity of command and unity of effort to the various services. So that when you launch, for example, an attack, your ground forces are supported by the Air Force and the Navy, and all these things work together. So we look to do that at DHS. Meant coming up with a common definition of the mission, setting up an integrating organization, which we had, for joint training and joint planning. And the idea was that over time, this would wind up allowing unity of effort among the various components.
Understood. I'm very curious to ask you about how you dealt with pressure and Homeland Security. You know, the agency and yourself, of course, were under a great deal of scrutiny and criticism, to put it mildly, right? I'd love to know, how did you personally work to deal with that pressure and, I suppose, stay focused?
Well, here I have to say, actually, this is where, oddly, being a trial lawyer turned out to be helpful, because when you're trying the case of a high-profile case, and, you know, things come up all the time you didn't anticipate, and you have to be able to put your nervousness and your concerns about what's going to happen out of your mind and focus on what do I need to do to address the problem or the issue that has just arisen. So essentially, you learn how to compartmentalize your thinking so that you don't spend time thinking about yourself and what does this mean to me and how is it going to affect me, but you simply take the problem and you figure out what is the solution. What do I have to do to deal with it? And that was, you know, more or less the attitude I took in the department. My general management style was to, if there was an issue, to listen to the various points of view, weigh them, ask questions, and then make a decision. And I found, by the way, that people, even if they don't get what they want, but they get a decision, that means an awful lot. What people don't like is a lot of dithering around and on the one hand, on the other hand. But it was really a question of putting out of my mind luxury, wondering about how am I doing, how is this going to affect me, what are people going to think of me, and rather than simply say, what are the things I need to fix the problem I'm facing or to deal with the challenges we're facing? And that came up with natural disasters. It came up when we were dealing with the August 2006 airline plot, and which would have blown up a dozen airliners going from Heathrow to the United States. It came up with issues that had to do with migration and legal immigration. All of these things needed to be dealt with in a practical way, making decisions promptly after you've heard all the information you hear, without simply self-reflecting.
Sure. Understood. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Focus, noise cancellation.
Correct. Signal, not noise.
Exact. Signal. I like that. I'm really excited to talk about the Patriot Act with you, sir, which you're credited as the co-author. You told Peter Robinson with the Hoover Institute a while back, to quote you, "These things," meaning the Patriot Act, "these things became political footballs," end quote. So to begin, I'd love to ask you, how would you describe the intentions of the Patriot Act?
And first, to be clear, the Patriot Act was passed by Congress.
Yes.
So I'm sure it was the washer of it. But I and a couple of my colleagues were designated by the Attorney General to be the Department of Justice representatives to Congress in terms of what we needed. And interestingly, the piece that was the most important and the moving motivation was not what everybody talks about, but was simply the information sharing. When I talked about earlier, the fact that until 9/11, the people on the criminal side could not be aware of Moussaoui, because his information was collected through an intelligence channel. Breaking down that barrier permanently, we realized, was necessary in order to prevent silos of intelligence and where you couldn't connect the dots. And that was a major part of the Patriot Act. Another part of the Patriot Act was allowing some of the techniques that were used in drug cases or fraud cases to be used in terrorism cases. You know, subpoenas, being able to request, you know, documents, things of that sort, which are perfectly normal criminal tools that are used in criminal cases, but had not been made available for terrorism. So it was designed to kind of level the playing field. A lot of the kind of myth that somehow this allowed wiretapping without a warrant, things is just simply wrong. Now, the point that became most controversial was you could use subpoenas to get what they call metadata. So that's like your telephone billing records or your metadata on your computer that show, you know, where you're logging on, what site and what site you're going to. Not the content, but the fact there's a connectivity. And again, for a long time, historically, things like phone records and metadata were available with a subpoena. You didn't need a warrant for it. So the idea was to simply apply that here. What did wind up happening was, as a policy matter, the FBI began to use these essentially equivalent of subpoenas to subpoena telecom and internet providers for all of the metadata they had collected. So it was a very, very broad information request. And there was a reason for that. The reason was you want to look for patterns that wouldn't be evident without getting all the data. But the problem is the volume of what was scooped up was pretty stunning because it looked like all the metadata. It would be as if all your phone records on your old analog phone were turned over to the FBI, you know, every day. So I think as a result of that, Congress sunsetted some of this and began to narrow and create more requirements before you could do a broad subpoena on metadata. And that's perfectly fair. But we do need to balance privacy and civil rights with law enforcement. As with anything else that you build quickly when you're in an emergency, as we were in 9/11, we started broadly, but on reflecting and looking at what the value proposition was, I think the determination was rightly made that it could be scaled down and more guardrails could be put in place.
Understood. Yeah, I understand that. Thank you. And actually, I believe you answered my next question into the fold as well, so I appreciate it. Yeah, and you may have answered this one as well, but let me go ahead and ask it. Is there any one particular misconception about the Patriot Act that you can think of? I know you said in another interview that many seem to think the Patriot Act authorized the war in Iraq.
I mean, I was slightly exaggerating when I said that, but I've heard people say the Patriot Act was responsible for things that had nothing to do with the Patriot Act. What I described is probably the most controversial thing in the Act. But I think partly the fact that Congress chose to use Patriot as the acronym for the Act created a sense that it was maybe more aggressive than it really was. So I don't think there's any other thing that was as fraught as the issue of the massive metadata collection.
Yeah, I understand that. So moving forward then, sir, where were you when you got word about Hurricane Katrina? And how did you respond once you got word?
You know, I was in the office and we were tracking the hurricanes. We had, you know, other hurricanes previously. I mean, I think there had been hurricanes earlier that year. We knew it was going to be headed to actually hit at the Mississippi coast. We reached out to the authorities in New Orleans and the governor, and they said they were, you know, preparing to respond. And then when the hurricane hit, we discovered that they actually weren't prepared to respond. They didn't really have a plan in place to evacuate people in various medical facilities or nursing homes, didn't have the equipment necessary to do the evacuations. The order to evacuate was not really given in a timely and prompt way. They didn't get the National Guard mobilized. The mayor at the time actually wound up hiding in a hotel room that was kind of absent without leave. And as a consequence, the evacuation, instead of taking place in an orderly way, was hasty. It was done at the end. A lot of them wound up in the sports arena, and others wound up, again, getting more or less stranded. We had a lot of rescues that we needed to carry out, so the Coast Guard did a magnificent job rescuing people. But a lot of people suffered.
Yeah. Thank you. I'd love to know, as you look back at your time with the DHS, was there a particular accomplishment that stands out for you?
Well, I mean, I think that we wound up actually rebuilding FEMA because one of the things we realized looking back was FEMA had not been constructed as a first responder. It was a supporting organization. To use the military analogy I used earlier, it was not a lead command. It was a supporting command. And the idea was that the tip of the spear, the actual people who would be out front most of the time and doing the interface with the citizens would be the state and local government, the National Guard. And what FEMA would bring would be some additional resources, maybe medical resources, and then obviously money to deal with damage and stuff like that. But in a case where the state defaulted and didn't actually do what it needed to do. Unlike, for example, California and Florida, which in which the state governments were superb in dealing with emergencies, and all the federal government had to do was give them assistance. But in a case where the state failed, the federal government had to be prepared to step in. And what that means is you have to have a plan. So we started to build the prospect of planning, particularly in the southern part of the U.S., for hurricanes and other foreseeable disasters, where we would make sure we had a very clear map of all the things we needed to worry about, where people were. We made sure there were plans about how to evacuate people. We considered when people should shelter in place, and we tried to provision for that. And the idea was to build all of that in advance. In most cases, you might not need it because the state could handle matters itself. But if they needed to get federal assistance in a more aggressive way, we needed to have on-call and on-tap contracts with buses, with medical facilities, and also to be able to deploy, for example, Coast Guard, TSA, and other personnel. When we actually dealt with Hurricane Gustav a couple of years later in Louisiana, we actually were able to bring all those plans to fruition, and they actually worked. So the planning we did between Katrina and Gustav, that 2 years, gave us the ability to move quickly, and we didn't have anything like the problem we had with Katrina. And that was really the great lesson, was planning is an everything. The plan may not survive first contact with the enemy, but the fact that you've planned and you know how to plan is very, very important in terms of being able to execute.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Moving forward a little bit, you told CNBC a couple years back that, to quote you, data is the new gold and the new oil, end quote. I know you penned the book Exploding Data. I'd love for you to speak a little bit more to that, if you don't mind.
Well, what we learned, I think, in the last 15 or 20 years is that people generate huge amounts of data, more than they think of. And not just when you go on Facebook or something like that, but what other people write about you, what your phone gives off in terms of geolocation, what your car gives off in geolocation. And what I think I started to realize when I wrote the book was that this was not only being held individually, but it was actually being pooled. And you had information brokers that were combining it. And when you started to add the beginnings of artificial intelligence and algorithms, it was possible for someone who wanted to track in exquisite detail what you're interested in, where you go, what your major concerns are, what your vulnerabilities are, and to use that for all kinds of purposes. The original reason was to sell you stuff. The idea is efficiently marketing products to you for commercial purposes. But as we saw in the 2016 election, this could also be used to target people for political purposes by sending them particular messages crafted to deal with their individual issues that they're concerned about, and also to separate what you send one group of people from another group so that you can really curate the message in a way that's very tailored. And what I started to become concerned about, which is why I wrote the book, is not just that you're going to be sold maybe stuff you don't need, or people are going to try to get your vote, but that it actually could be a way to rob you of your freedom. So imagine this. Imagine that your insurance company, your health insurance company, gets all this data and crunches it, and then you start getting called. We're going to raise your insurance because 2 weeks ago you bought a very fatty slab of meat. And then later you also bought wine and you were driving home after you had this in a car and you had a glass of wine. And basically what would wind up happening is you'd be looking over your shoulder for everything you do, asking, am I going to be punished for this? Or am I going to wind up having to pay a price for it? And then, of course, imagine even more so if you're not just dealing with insurance companies or employers, but you're dealing perhaps with a government that's malevolent and wants to know what you're doing and whether you're being disloyal. And exhibit A, that is China. Of course, the Chinese are doing to the Uyghurs.
Social credit and the Uyghurs, exactly. Indeed. Yep. I'm curious, this isn't part of my question sheet, but I'm terribly curious if the irony has ever occurred to you of the same people that were commenting on the Patriot Act and over surveillance and so forth now willingly give it away, you know, anytime they buy a cell phone, anything with a SIM card. Has that irony ever struck you?
It has, but it also makes me realize that, you know, it's very difficult in this day and age sometimes to avoid generating data. I mean, you know, obviously you can avoid things by not going on social media, by not tweeting. You can be careful to be blunt. What use search engines for? Because as we saw, you know, with radicalization, sometimes groups that want to radicalize see what you're searching for. And if you're hit on a particular site, there'll be a recommendation. Oh, you might be interested in this. And that tends to pull you into the more extreme rabbit hole of the subject you're looking at. So, I mean, some of this is in your control, but the part that's not is everybody who's around you decides they want to take a picture of you, or they even want to record what you're saying if they can hear it, if they think it's interesting and they want to put it on TikTok. Now add to that that you have China, which is trying to collect massive amounts of data and use AI for purposes of being able to conduct intelligence operations and or disinformation operations. So the question is, can you empower people to have ways in which they not only don't generate data, but others don't generate data? And to me, the solution is not to try any longer to stop the collection of data, because you can't, but to then give you control of the data, give you a legal right to say, before someone sells your data or uses it for some purpose, you have to agree to it or say, no, I don't want to do it.
Yeah, I understand that. We're making good time, Mr. Secretary. I just have a few questions left, if that's okay. I appreciate that. I'd love to know, sir, what advice would you give to young people who are interested in pursuing a career of public service or national security?
I mean, I think public service is a fascinating career. I think it's meaningful. They do a lot of good. And I think, you know, I would suggest that people should find a specialty, something they're interested in, use their opportunity in college or even graduate school to study it further, try to take summer jobs or internships that expose you to organizations that are doing this kind of work, and then figure out what fits within your interests and what you're comfortable with in terms of your politics, and sign up for something.
Perfect. I can't have you on and not discuss leadership a little bit. I know we did a little bit earlier. I'd love to ask you, what are some of the most important qualities that you think a leader should possess, and how can those qualities be developed over time?
So someone once said, character is what you do when no one is looking. And I would put it at the top of the list, character and integrity and telling the truth. Because if you don't have an ethical compass, a sense of mission, and a sense that you're going to do the right thing even when nobody's looking, then I think you can't be a good leader. I remember when I was starting out as a prosecutor, it was drilled into us. You have certain legal obligations to make exculpatory evidence available to a defendant. Whether or not the defendant's attorney knows you have that evidence, you have a moral obligation to live up to that. You don't suppress it or sit on it. And most prosecutors I knew obeyed that. So I'd say character and ethics is number one. I think decisiveness. I mean, if you spend a lot of time worrying about everything, you'll never get anything done. Then essentially you're making a decision by default, and the decision is not to do something. So I think hearing all sides, but then ultimately being willing to make a decision and take responsibility for it is also important. And third, I think, is the ability to communicate your intent. It's what they call the commander's intent in the military. You need not just to be cryptic, but to explain to people contextually why they've made the decision, what the outcome you're looking for is, and then if something comes up that's a problem, to encourage them to come back to you.
Wonderful. Thank you, sir. I'd love to ask you, what is the Chertoff Group?
So after I left government, my chief of staff and I set up a group to consult in the area of security, because we were interested in continuing to work in this area. And, you know, we wound up getting involved in cybersecurity, physical security. We also set up an investment bank to advise on buying and selling assets in the security space. And the idea was to use our expertise, both academic and practical, and to bring aboard people who were, again, former senior people in the national security arena, so they could give advice to. And the idea was to help American companies and American government agencies, as well as friendly nations, better secure themselves, initially against just terrorism and violence, but also broadening out cyber attacks, which are now a very, very big deal, even physical attacks by extreme groups, and also dealing with geopolitical risk in general. And so we've got a large group of people who work full-time and a large group that worked on a kind of by, you know, episode by episode. who have experience with DOD, DHS, the intelligence community, policing, the FBI. And what we try to do is increase the security and the awareness that our clients have. We want to do well, we want to do good.
Yeah, indeed. Excellent. Well, Mr. Secretary, that was all I had for you, sir.
Well, great questions. And
thank you.
I look forward to seeing the product.
Yeah, my pleasure. I will send it. It was such a pleasure speaking with you. I appreciate you taking the time once again.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.